Imagine it's September 1st, 1891 in New Orleans. You're just stepping off a busy train car, and it's good to be back in the city. The sun is setting, and there's a hint of jasmine floating on the breeze. You're making your way through an open-air depot when you run into your friend Louis.
Louis! Hey, Louis! Hey, how are you?
He's impossible to miss. The man is always dressed to the nines in the same black suit, black bow tie, and wide-brim hat.
Well, I've been better, and I've been worse. Are those flowers in your hand for me? Oh, you didn't have to.
Well, Louis's ever the joker. The flowers are for your mother. She doesn't get out much anymore. You've been running errands for her today.
Well, it's funny to see you here. I thought you'd be busy with the paper, Louis.
Louis is the editor of the Crusader, a paper you like to read when you get the time. You and Louis are both Creole, of mixed black and European descent, and both light-skinned. You also share an abiding hatred of the rampant racial discrimination in this country.
Well, in a way, I am. Today, I'm watching the trains. What's that?
Let me ask you a question. Which car did you take just now?
The white one?
Louis, you know I didn't take the white one. You watched me get off.
Well, that's fair enough. But with your complexion, you could have taken the white one. And probably no one would have known. Why didn't you?
Well, maybe I could have, but... it's not a chance I want to take. Ever since they passed that separate car law, I'm just not as daring as you.
All aboard!
Listen, why don't you come by my office on Friday? We're having a special meeting. I think the subject matter might interest you.
But don't be coy with me. What is it?
Well, we're forming a citizens' committee to overturn the Separate Car Act. These kind of laws are senseless. It's not 1858. We've come too far since the war.
Well, you know I agree.
Good. Because we're going to overturn this law. We'll build a test case against it. Take it all the way to the Supreme Court. I'm wondering if you want to help.
Louis, I'd be happy to, but my mother isn't well these days. Perhaps I can let you know?
Well, certainly. And give my best to your mother. I hope she has a speedy recovery. But don't wait too long. We need you. Frankly, we need all the help we can get.
The train's leaving the station, and you need to be on your way, too. But the idea has gotten you excited. A citizens' committee. You roll the phrase around in your mind. As long as your mother's okay, you're going to go on Friday and see what this group is all about. It's a tall task to get rid of these racist laws, but any group daring enough to try is one you're interested in joining.
American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. I like puzzles. I like adventure. I like clever people. I like things on the edge, which means I love mysteries. The perfect combination of storytelling, mental challenge, and often murder. Like in the Penguin modern classic, Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals, ready to listen whenever, wherever, on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. That's audible.com/tellers or text tellers to 500-500. American History Tellers is sponsored by Audible. Listen to a new bold take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Ilan Ishkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. A chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion, now more relevant than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American History Tellers. Our history, your story.
By the 1890s, American society was defined in black and white, and American laws enforced these boundaries. The term Jim Crow was shorthand for the pervasive laws that enforced racial segregation. The term came from a minstrel routine and was also a derogatory epithet for black Americans, a designation of their separate status.
White politicians and militant groups pushed for Jim Crow laws after the U.S. passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the ones officially ending slavery, guaranteeing equal protection, and ensuring the right to vote for black men. These segregation laws attempted to reassert white supremacy and restrict black people into inferior schools, parks, restaurants, and public transportation. But for the citizens of New Orleans, many of whom were Creole or mixed race, the question of whether a person was black or white was complex. They hailed from a rich and diverse culture that defied simple categorizations. The Supreme Court hadn't ruled explicitly on race since before the Civil War, but a black activist group in Louisiana would try and change that. They would do it by forming a test case, a case that would force the Supreme Court to strike down segregation laws throughout the country. And they were going to do it with a 29-year-old shoemaker's ride on a train car. This is Episode 3, Separate and Unequal. In the summer of 1890, the Louisiana State Legislature passed a law called the Separate Cars Act, requiring that railroads maintain different cars for black and white passengers. The legislation called for accommodations to be equal but separate. The punishment for violating this fine was $25 or 20 days in jail. Louis Martinet was angered by the passing of the Separate Cars Act, but he was not surprised. Just 1 year before, Martinet, a former attorney, had started a newspaper as an alternative to the racist language that appeared in the city's dailies. It was called The Crusader. Published weekly, Martinet's paper billed itself as newsy, spicy, progressive, stalwart, and fearless. And it often lived up to the promise. Martinet was 41 years old enough to remember the institution of slavery. Born in 1849 to a Belgian father and a free black mother, he had grown up in a prominent Creole family in a rural parish west of Baton Rouge. He was a teenager when the Civil War ended and the 13th and 14th Amendments ended slavery and promised equal rights to black citizens. Because of those amendments, Louis Martinet had been able to attend law school with other black students. He was admitted to the Louisiana State Bar. He could vote and seek elected office. Martinet had even served one term in the Louisiana State Legislature. But following passage of these amendments, Southern whites launched a campaign to reinforce a strict racial hierarchy. They stripped black citizens of their rights and restricted their access to the polls. Then in 1877, President Rutherford B. Hayes withdrew federal troops from Louisiana, the last Southern state to have government forces, officially ending Reconstruction. Without a strong federal presence, local politicians and violent militia groups like the White League in New Orleans quickly eroded whatever gains former slaves had secured and spread violence on the streets. But despite intimidation, black people voted and were politically active. By 1890, black men worked in the police department. The Louisiana legislature that passed the Separate Cars Act had 16 black members. And now those same legislators were prevented from traveling in a train car with their white colleagues. Lawmakers said that they had introduced the law to promote the comfort of passengers in railway trains. But the racial animus behind it was clear. Next door in Mississippi, lawmakers had just drafted a new state constitution that imposed poll taxes and literacy tests, vastly reducing the number of black voters and even some whites. By Louis Martinet's reckoning, Louisiana's Separate Cars Act had a similar aim. What's more, it was unconstitutional because of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. He thought the time was right for it to be challenged and that people of color had the political will to overturn it. In the pages of his newspaper, Martinet laid out his plan for all to see, writing, "We'll make a case, a test case, and bring it before the federal court on the grounds of the invasion of the right of a person to travel through the states unmolested." And so with his plan set, all he had to do was find the right test case. The offices of the Crusader soon became home to a small group of activists who sought to challenge the constitutionality of the Separate Car Act. Calling themselves the Comité des Citoyens, or Citizens Committee, the group's members included educators, businessmen, lawyers, and government workers. By 1891, the Citizens Committee was holding rallies and fundraisers. Meanwhile, Martinet began secret negotiations with the Louisville and Nashville Railroad Company, which agreed to offer assistance to the group. From the railroad company's standpoint, the Separate Cars Act was terrible for business. They had to pay for extra cars that might only be half used. Additionally, their employees were saddled with the burden of becoming the state's racial police. Ultimately, it would have been cheaper for the company if the state had mandated integration instead. the Louisville and Nashville Railroad would be a silent partner in the script of civil disobedience that Martinet was writing, and it was their train cars that would be the stage. Next, Martinet recruited his plaintiffs. The first man was Daniel Dedunes, a young Creole musician who was the son of one of the committee members. In February 1892, Daniel boarded a train headed to Mobile, Alabama, and was arrested and charged for sitting in the car reserved for whites. But there would need to be a second man on a second train. Since the committee was unsure which might prove to be the better case, they had to challenge the Separate Cars Act on trains running both outside and inside the state of Louisiana. The second plaintiff was named Homer Plessy. Plessy was a 29-year-old shoemaker from New Orleans affiliated with the committee. He had never been arrested before. Like Dedunes, Plessy was light-skinned. His family was Haitian and French and had lived in New Orleans since the 1790s. And it was his appearance that was the most important element, since Homer Plessy needed to be able to buy a ticket and take a seat in a whites-only train car without arousing any suspicion. Only once Plessy had taken his seat and the train had begun to move would the next phase of the plan begin. Imagine it's June 7th, 1892, a warm, cloudy day just after 4 in the afternoon. You're the train conductor for this East Louisiana railroad trip from Covington and the resort towns just across Lake Pontchartrain. Today, you're in the first class car, collecting tickets from the passengers. One by one, you inspect the destination and the stamp.
Tickets, please. Ma'am, can I see your ticket?
You started working for the railroad 2 years ago, just after the Separate Car Act passed. Your first week, you had to put up the signs designating which cars were for black people and which were for whites. You thought the law was stupid, and it's even more stupid now that it's your job to enforce it.
Sir, ticket, please.
The man in front of you is calm as he hands you his ticket. He's polite. He looks as white as you. He must be Homer Plessy. You were never told what the man would look like, just his seat number. You check the ticket one last time, then look him in the eye and say the words you're supposed to.
Are you a colored man?
Yes, I am.
Then you will have to retire to the colored car.
I will not.
I am an American citizen, and I paid for my ticket. The train goes to Covington, and I intend to ride it to Covington. If you won't remove yourself to the colored car, then I'm going to have to remove you from this train. I will stay right where I am.
With that, you pull the bell, signaling the conductor. The train slowly grinds to a halt, and the other passengers groan. It doesn't take long for the private detective from the train station to climb into the stop train car. You've never seen the detective before either, but he's about to play his part.
Sir, if you are colored, you should go to the train car set apart for your race. The law is plain, and it must be obeyed.
But Homer Plessy doesn't move. He just looks up at you and at the detective.
All right, then. You're just going to have to come with us.
Plessy stands up as the detective places cuffs on him. You almost want to clap yourself, but for a totally different reason. The people on this train have no idea that they're actually helping the Citizens Committee's test case. Just like you, the detective, and Homer Plessy. Everything's going according to plan. Homer Plessy was bailed out of jail that evening. Both the train conductor, J.J. Dalling, and private detective Christopher C. Kane had been hired by the Citizens Committee. They had played their parts well, and now Homer Plessy had a case. The New Orleans Daily Picayune greeted the story with jeers. Another Jim Crow car case, read the headline, while it promised the reader further details on the arrest of a Negro traveler who persisted in riding with the white people. Just 2 days later, Martinet received a notice that New Orleans criminal court judge John Ferguson had thrown out Daniel Dedunes' case. Interstate travel was a federal matter, not a state one. But Judge Ferguson would hear Plessy's case. It was a good thing that Martinet had pressed for two different arrests. Homer Plessy was going to get his day in court in New Orleans. On November 18, 1892, Homer Plessy appeared before Judge Ferguson. Ferguson wasted little time pronouncing Homer Plessy guilty of violating the state's law, declaring, "There is no pretense that he was not provided with equal accommodations of the white passengers. Plessy was simply deprived of the liberty of doing as he pleased." Then, upon appeal, the Louisiana State Supreme Court upheld Judge Ferguson's ruling. The case of Plessy v. Ferguson was headed to the Supreme Court, but the road to challenging racial segregation in Louisiana would be anything but smooth. Faced with unsympathetic justices, Plessy's legal team would gain a faraway ally, a lawyer who would be instrumental in attempting to strike down injustice throughout the country.
American History Tellers is sponsored by NetSuite. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, switch to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you'll reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud, no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/tellers. That's netsuite.com/tellers. netsuite.com/tellers. American History Tellers is sponsored by Field of Greens. I turned 50 this past February, and at milestones like these, you start to make promises. This is the year I get healthy, you might say, or the year I pay attention to what I eat. Because even if you're turning just 30, you're not the same spring chicken you were. And turning 40? Well, that's when you really start to notice. So at 50, I'm definitely paying more attention to my body. Exercising, eating well, and finding ways to improve my health that are actually things I can accomplish. Field of Greens is one of those. It's literally one scoop a day, packed with organic fruit and vegetables to support heart and vital organ health. My first shipment is arriving this week, and it'll become part of my morning routine. Maybe it should be part of yours. Field of Greens offers a 100% money-back guarantee, so it's a no-risk, easy step towards better nutrition. Plus, I've got you 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Just visit fieldofgreens.com and use promo code AHT. That's promo code AHT at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. As Plessy v. Ferguson drew closer to the Supreme Court, the excitement from Louis Martinet and the Citizens Committee in New Orleans grew. It was their chance to finally overturn the segregation policies that restricted their travel and enforced their second-class status. But Martinet still had one more important task. A Louisiana lawyer had handled the case so far in the New Orleans courts, but Martinet needed someone else, someone who could argue Homer Plessy's case on a national stage. Martinet would find his man, 1,000 miles away, in upstate New York. Albion Tourge was 53 years old. Known primarily as a novelist, he wore a glass eye and had adopted an accent mark to sit atop the first E in Tourge. The last case he'd argued in front of the Supreme Court had been 20 years ago. So while out of practice and a bit eccentric, Tourge was also a prominent white advocate for black civil rights. A former Union soldier, Tourge had been a judge in Reconstruction-era North Carolina, where he ruled against the Ku Klux Klan and spoke openly against racist politics. Retiring from the bench, Tourge had moved back to upstate New York, but stayed involved in the fight against racist lawmaking. So far, Albion Tourge had helped construct Homer Plessy's entire case through writing letters to the Citizens Committee from his home in New York. In one, he stressed the futility of defining racial categories. "Race is a scientific and legal question of great difficulty," Tourge wrote. Technically, Homer Plessy was only 1/8 black. In Tourge's view, this percentage proved the absurdity of the separate car law. It was unreasonable to write racial classifications into law, and even more ludicrous to empower train conductors to make those distinctions. And even if there were a clear and simple way to distinguish black from white, which there was not, the state's law violated the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection under the law. But Tourge knew it would not be easy to convince the justices of the Supreme Court to share his reasoning. Over the years, the Supreme Court had often helped to reinforce and even strengthen racial divisions. In 1858, the court had ruled in Dred Scott v. Sanford that black men and women were not people, but property. Chief Justice Roger Taney had written for the majority that constitutionally, black people were a subordinate and inferior class of beings with no rights which the white man was bound to respect. That ruling and its fallout helped to inflame debate around slavery and usher in the Civil War.
After the war, slavery was abolished. Black people became official citizens of the United States, and they were promised equal protection under the law. In 1875, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act. This legislation was a positive step towards ensuring equal access to housing, public transportation, and social accommodations for people of color. But in less than a decade, the Supreme Court struck down the anti-discriminatory provisions of that law. In a set of five related cases decided under the heading of Civil Rights Cases of 1883, the court declared the Civil Rights Act unconstitutional. Speaking for an 8-1 majority, Justice Joseph Bradley ruled that the equal protections of the 14th Amendment did not give Congress the power to ban private acts of racial discrimination. He wrote in his opinion, "When a man has emerged from slavery, there must be some stage in the process of his elevation when he takes the rank of a mere citizen and ceases to be the special favorite of the laws." It had only been 2 decades since the end of slavery, a system that had fueled American growth for more than 2 centuries. Yet the Supreme Court's ruling suggested that black people had no legal claim to try and fight racial discrimination. This suggestion was still very much in place nearly 10 years later, when Louisiana Judge Ferguson ruled it was a crime for Homer Plessy to ride in a whites-only car. But the Citizens Committee had expected Ferguson to rule this way. In a way, they'd planted a legal trap, and Ferguson had sprung it. But it would take until 1896 for Plessy's case to make its way to the Supreme Court bench. For 3 years, there was nothing to do but wait and try and build the best case possible. Imagine it's 1896. You live in the town of Maysville in upstate New York. It's a wonderful place in the summer when the days are 12 hours long and the breeze comes in off the water. Today, you've ridden around the edge of Lake Chautauqua to the house of Albion Tourjay. You've been friends with his family ever since they settled up here 15 years ago. You find him on the lawn outside his house, pacing in the grass.
Albion, what are you doing out here?
My wife told me if I'm going to continue pacing, it's best I do it outside so I can more fully take in the fresh air.
So she wants to be rid of you? Yes, yes, and I can't blame her. I haven't been sleeping well.
You know that Albion's worried. You can see it in his face, and you suspect the cause is the same reason you stopped by for this casual visit. Any idea when the Supreme Court might call you for the Plessy case? None. None at all. The highest court in the land doesn't like to bother with little things like advance notice. You get the call, and off you trot. Every day I have to tell myself, don't worry, it's just the whole history of racial relations in this country riding on the decision, so just keep waiting.
Albion paces around the side of the house, and you follow him to a small pile of wood.
Well, you can't think of it that way. That's an impossible mountain to move.
True. But I've always been a fool.
Albion picks up an axe, swings it, and brings it down sharply, splitting a wooden log in two.
I was certainly a fool trying to fight the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina.
No, you were not. You were a judge. The bench is a powerful place. Change comes from it.
Ah, change.
More often, entrenchment is the only decision justices really make. If we lose, it'll be worse than if we ever tried to overturn that damn law in the first place.
And there it is, the worry that's been keeping you up at night, too.
You never considered that possibility?
To be honest, I didn't give it much thought in the beginning, no.
Our chances seem so strong. But if the Supreme Court upholds the Separate Car Act, it could become the law of the land. One terrifyingly short-sighted law in one backward state could then be codified as proof that any state could do the same. And then,
Albion stops, as if he's seeing you again for the first time.
Yes, yeah, and then I would have to ride in a separate train car in every state, Albion.
Albion's face falls.
The stakes are highest for you, I am very aware.
You give him a tight smile, the same one you give all your white friends when the topic of race comes up.
I know you'll bring the best case you can. God knows I'm trying, but that's all you can do. Now, can we go inside and find something to eat?
Albion nods and gives you a small smile. It makes you feel good to see his spirits up, even for a moment. He stands a better chance if he's confident. Now, if you could only just calm your own fears. You put your arm around his shoulder, and the two of you head inside together.
By 1896, it had been 4 years since Homer Plessy's arrest,
Despite any misgivings he might have had, Tourjet still remained confident in Homer Plessy's case and confident in the handful of justices who might swing a ruling in his favor. Foremost of these was Associate Justice John Marshall Harlan, whose views on the subject of race were complex. Harlan had grown up in Kentucky to a landed, slaveholding family. He'd supported the Union, but considered the end of slavery to be a violation of property rights. After the Civil War, Harlan's attitudes toward black civil rights had shifted to a more open-minded stance. He'd been the lone holdout in the Supreme Court's 1883 decision overturning the Civil Rights Act, and he was a vocal dissenter in many other cases, often pounding on the desk and shaking his finger at his fellow justices. Sharing the bench with Harlan were two other Republican justices, Horace Gray and David Brewer. These were the men Albion Tourjet felt relatively certain would vote along party lines, and that meant for his client. Justices Rufus Peckham, George Shiras, and Harry Billings Brown were the swing votes. All were Northerners, and Shiras and Brown were both Republican, but in the past, they had also demonstrated more enthusiasm in upholding states' rights than equal rights. The last three justices, including Chief Justice Melville Fuller, were nearly lost causes. But they tended to rule in favor of cases involving contract law and property law. Chief Justice Fuller believed in the sanctity of an unregulated market. Perhaps if Tourjet could connect Plessy's case to a property argument, he'd have a chance. But Tourjet didn't need Fuller. He only needed 5 votes out of 9. If Harlan, Gray, and Brewer came through, Tourjet would only need 2 swing votes to win. On April 13, 1896, Albion Tourjet was finally summoned to Washington to make his case. The oral arguments in Plessy v. Ferguson were the only ones the court had scheduled for the day. Tourjet spoke from note cards he had written out beforehand, but the ideas had been developed with Louis Martinet and Tourjet's co-counsel, James C. Walker, the lawyer who had first tried the case in Louisiana. Neither of them could attend the hearing. "The gist of our case," Tourjet began, "is the unconstitutionality of the Separate Cars Act. The 14th Amendment, still less than 30 years old, guaranteed that any person born in the United States was a citizen, that they could not be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. Nor could they be denied the equal protection of the law." These words, equal protection, were the circle Tourjet drew around Plessy's case. Tourjet asked the justices of the court to consider what would happen if train conductors were authorized to classify men and women by race. What visual cues would they use, and where would the line drawing stop? "Why may the state not require all red-headed people to ride in a separate car?" Tourjet asked. "Why not require white and black people to walk on separate sides of the street? A white man's house could be painted white, and a black man's house black. Surely these steps could formalize both the separation and the equality of the races supposedly required in Louisiana state law." After he posed these questions, Tourjet pivoted. "If a person's race was so essential to their reputation, didn't their race also approximate a property right?" Tourjet asked the justices for a moment, imagine themselves as black people. "How much would it be worth to a young man entering upon the practice of law to be regarded as a white man rather than a colored one? 6/7 of the population are white. 19/20 of the country's property is owned by white people. Indeed, is reputation not the most valuable sort of property, being the master key that unlocks the golden door of opportunity?" In closing, Tourjet argued that the only real effect of the separate car law was to perpetuate the stigma of color, to make the curse immortal, incurable, inevitable. With those words, he closed his case. Buried under precedent and arguments and pages of legalese lay Homer Plessy's freedom to catch any train he wanted. And the court's decision would have far-reaching consequences, not just for Homer Plessy, but for every state in the Union. American History Tellers is sponsored by the podcast Expedition Unknown. Did you know that there's proof that Robin Hood might have been a real person, even using secret underground passageways to rob the rich, or that gold coins discovered in Florida may be connected to a Spanish treasure fleet? On the Expedition Unknown podcast from Discovery, host Josh Gates travels the world to investigate these and more of history's greatest unsolved mysteries. He'll take you looking for art stolen by the Nazis,
exploring mysterious caves in Nepal, and deciphering giant geoglyphs drawn into the earth in Peru. Travel the globe with Josh Gates as he investigates some of humanity's greatest feats and most iconic legends. Listen to Expedition Unknown wherever you get your podcasts. American History Tellers is sponsored by ZBiotics. Last week, I went to a big podcast conference with tons of meetings and a lot of happy hours. So the nights were late and the drinks were many. Sometimes you need to choose between a fun evening and a good morning. Or maybe not, if I had just remembered to pack my ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink, the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. Invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking, it creates an enzyme that breaks down a toxic byproduct produced in the gut when you drink alcohol. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. You just need to remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. I wish I did. Vacations, weddings, birthdays, and reunions, there's so much going on, so get the most out of your spring plans by stocking up on pre-alcohol now. Go to ZBiotics.com/tellers to get 15% off your first order when you use tellers at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/tellers and use the code TELLERS at checkout for 15% off. On May 18, 1896, the Supreme Court handed down its verdict in the case of Plessy v. Ferguson. It was just a little over a month since Algy and Torji had traveled to Washington to argue Plessy's case. In a 7-1 vote, the court ruled in favor of Louisiana's Separate Car Act and against Homer Plessy. In spite of Torje's calculations, all but Justice John Marshall Harlan had ruled against his client. Now, any one of the country's 45 states could forcibly and legally segregate people of different races. Even though the decision was nearly unanimous, it was written not by Chief Justice Melville Fuller, but by Associate Justice Henry Billings Brown. Brown's opinion dismissed Plessy's 14th Amendment claims and pointed to the existence of separate schools and bans on interracial marriage to justify Louisiana's segregation law. The court acknowledged that race may be difficult to pin down, but left it up to the states to determine their own criteria. So long as facilities were equal, the separation was perfectly legal. The court could see no so-called badge of inferiority, even if black people chose to see it as such. Finally, Justice Brown concluded, "If one race be inferior to the other socially, the Constitution of the United States cannot put them on the same plane." Justice Brown concluded that although society may be unjust, it wasn't the role of the courts or any branch of the government to right that wrong. The court's decision did not create any new justifications for racial segregation. It only locked the old justifications into place. Separate but equal, and with it legal justification for white supremacy, was now the law of the land. Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote a blistering dissent. "In the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior, dominant, ruling class of citizens. There is no caste here. Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among its citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law." Harlan continued with a warning. "The judgment this day rendered will, in time, prove to be quite as pernicious as the decision made by this tribunal in the Dred Scott case." Harlan would be proved right, but his was just one voice out of seven, and the justices had plenty else to attend to. That day, the court also handed out decisions in 52 other cases. Three of these decisions were reported on from the front page of the New York Times. Plessy v. Ferguson was not among them. Back in Louisiana, Homer Plessy had been found guilty, and now he needed to pay the price. Imagine it's January 1897. It's been 5 years since you first represented Homer Plessy as his lead counsel in New Orleans, looking to challenge the Separate Car Act. And it's been just 8 months since the Supreme Court handed down the decision you and your co-counsel, Albion Torji, were dreading. Today, you've returned to the New Orleans criminal courthouse with your client in order that he may pay the fine he owes to the state of Louisiana. Your client is a bit nervous. "I hope this isn't going to take long. It was hard enough to get the morning off work as it is." You feel for him. Homer stopped making shoes a while ago. On the way over, he told you he'd started working in a warehouse downtown. "Who's the judge? I don't see Judge Ferguson anywhere." "No, his term expired."
The new judge calls the room to order.
In the matter of Plessy v. Ferguson, I hear that we have counsel and defendant before us?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you'd like to change the plea recorded July 20th, 1892 of not guilty?
Your Honor, my client would like to change that plea to guilty. We'd like to waive all legal delay and be sentenced immediately.
Beside you, you can feel Homer's body stiffen in anger at the word guilty, but he doesn't say anything.
So noted. Homer Adolph Plessy, you have pled guilty according to the provisions of Section 2 of Act No. 111 of the General Assembly. Approved July 10, 1890, you are sentenced to the fine of $25, or in default payment thereof, to imprisonment in the parish prison for 20 days.
My client will pay the $25, sir.
So noted.
But Homer won't be paying with his money. The Citizens Committee raised the $25, but since disbanded. You're one of the last members left, you and Homer. You helped build Homer's case, the test case, with Albion Torgi. You were supposed to travel north and present it at the Supreme Court, but you had to back out for health reasons. Every step of this case was planned, every move, except the part where you lost. The court's business for the day continues while you and your client make your way into the hallway and past the other defendants awaiting adjudication. Homer turns and shakes your hand.
Well, I'll be seeing you. Goodbye, Homer. I'm sorry we didn't win.
Homer turns and heads down the hallway. You watch him go, past the swinging doors and out into the streets. Just another man headed back to work. The Citizens Committee folded in late 1896, not long after the Supreme Court's decision. And Louis Martinet's newspaper, The Crusader, would soon close as well. But in one of its final issues, Martinet reasserted his commitment to the fight. "We as free men still believe that we were right and that our cause is sacred." Martinet withdrew himself from the public arena. He would not publish again, but continued to live in New Orleans until his death in 1917. Albion Torgi, too, was bitterly discouraged by his loss in the Plessy case. He died in France in 1905. As for Homer Plessy, his brief tenure in civil disobedience was over. He continued working as a warehouseman, as a clerk, and eventually took up a position at the black-owned People's Life Insurance Company. He died in 1925 at the age of 62. Plessy versus Ferguson gave the doctrine of separate but equal legal protection that stood for the next 60 years. The Supreme Court's decision helped to erode the gains of the Reconstruction era. It also struck a blow to the promise of the 14th Amendment and ushered in decades of racial inequality in the South. The same year Homer Plessy pled guilty and paid his fine in criminal court, the state of Louisiana held a new constitutional convention in New Orleans. The Judiciary Committee chairman of this convention bluntly declared, "We met here to establish the supremacy of the white race. Our mission is to establish the extent to which white manhood suffrage could be legally and constitutionally done." Meeting for over 66 days, the convention passed a series of new constitutional bylaws stripping voting rights from black citizens of the state. Later that year, the Louisiana Governor Murphy Foster approved these changes and gave a speech as a toast. "The white supremacy for which we have so long struggled, at the cost of so much precious blood and treasure, is gathering itself in a common brotherhood for the exercise of its unified power." Between 1897 and 1900, the state of Louisiana purged approximately 129,000 black voters from its rolls. Meanwhile, registration among white voters surged. 96% of eligible white voters now went to the polls, up from just 56% a few years before. Segregation also expanded to Louisiana streetcars and public water fountains. White majority rule became entrenched as the law of the land, while lynchings and violence against black people spiked in the region. But amidst all this turmoil, black activists organized and fought back. A group of 29 activists from 14 states founded the Niagara Movement. One of their founders was W.E.B. Du Bois, who called for the reestablishment of basic rights for black citizens in a speech at Harper's Ferry in 1906, saying, "We want full manhood suffrage, and we want it now. Henceforth, and forever. We want discrimination and public accommodation to cease. Separation in railway and streetcars based simply on race and color is un-American, undemocratic, and silly. We want the law enforced against rich as well as poor, against capitalists as well as laborer, against white as well as black." Du Bois and other Niagara Movement members would found the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP, in 1909.
The organization would be a leading force in the fight to roll back disenfranchisement and institutional racism throughout the country. It would help to ensure that the decision of the Supreme Court in Plessy versus Ferguson would not be the last word, and that the bold arguments of Louis Martinet and the Citizens Committee in New Orleans and the train ride of Homer Plessy would not be forgotten. Next, on American History Tellers, an executive order in 1942 leads to the forced internment of thousands of Japanese Americans in the United States. As World War II rages across the ocean, a young man named Fred Korematsu defies the military and challenges President Franklin Roosevelt in the halls of the Supreme Court. From Wondery, this is episode 3 of Supreme Court Landmarks for American History Tellers. I also have two other podcasts you might like, American Scandal and American Elections Wicked Game. For more information on Plessy v. Ferguson, we recommend We as Free Men by Keith Weldon Medley. American History Tellers is hosted, edited, and produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by George Ducker. Edited by Dorian Marina. Our executive producers are Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery. Wondery Plus subscribers can binge American History Tellers early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy American History Tellers, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. I read every one of them. I also have two other Wondery podcasts you might like, American Scandal and Business Movers. Follow American History Tellers on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of American History Tellers early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. And to find out more about me, including my other podcasts, go to notthatlindseygraham.com. That's notthatlindseygraham.com.